Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host, bringing you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Sundays from at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m., Monday mornings at 1 a.m., streaming live at richarddugan.com and newspress.com. We archive these programs at richarddugan.com, the radio show's page, and we also link to our guests' website so you can get all the information that you need about what they're talking about. Today is it's an interesting, I'll say, twist on the conversations that we have had over the years about transitioning, death, and dying, because it's not often that you sit and you discuss this process. Now, I've actually had the conversation with my mother in regards to having things taken care of. Matter of fact, to the point, I've already received a copy of the will. I don't know what that all means, and I'm, you know, I'm pleased with, not that, you know, this is the weird thing. I'm pleased with what they've decided to do in the will, but you know what? It doesn't matter whether I'm pleased with it. It's their stuff. We're not actually going to be talking about creating wills and things, but we're going to be talking about preparations. What kind of preparations have you made? We're going to be talking with the author of Sunrises and Sunsets, Final Affairs Forged with Flair, Fitness, I beg your pardon, that's Finesse and Functionality. I'll get the correct pronunciation of that new word from Holly Kelly, MSCPG. We'll find out what all those acronyms stand for, and thank you so much for joining us on the program today.
Oh, it is certainly my pleasure, Richard. Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to be your guest.
This is something that is sort of the other side of the conversation that we have on a fairly regular basis on this program when we talk about transitioning, as I use the term, because death and dying always seem to have rather a lot of negative energy associated with them. But it's something that, and I think I have to put it in this context, Holly, and that is that in our world today, not that this has really changed, but it's more in the forefront of the minds of almost every person on the planet today, that they don't know if today is going to be their last. Not just due to any number of medical conditions, not due to any plethora of possible accidents and mishaps and so forth, but also due to, you know, man's inhumanity to man. And that seems to have taken center stage for a lot of folks. And not that we're here to try to alleviate that fear as much as, what if? Have you taken care of what needs to be taken care of in that process? Am I close to sort of putting a not a cap on it, but kind of opening up the box and getting started with this conversation?
I would absolutely say that you are, and we do as a society avoid the words death and dying. They are words considered to be dark. I think that people feel that perhaps they may be contagious if we say them. So we have other better fitting words such as passing on, mm-hmm. or going to another place, the end, and so many different ways that we describe what we know is our inevitable destiny for each of us, any living thing. And we recognize this, and yet it doesn't make us any more comfortable with the topic. The truth is that when proper, thoughtful, meaningful planning is done at any age, this concept that's looming over all of us that we prefer to ignore becomes something that doesn't hold the power that it did previously. We become at peace with it because we have taken care of, through the planning that we've put in place, the many loose ends. We've kind of put our house in order, if you will, and we faced it, mm-hmm. both personally and in the many ways that we've designed how things would be upon our exit. And so, amazingly, there is an incredible amount of liberating freedom that happens when we stop ignoring it, we put the planning in place. You are extremely peaceful post-planning for your inevitable departure.
I know that I used to, I would talk with people primarily around tax time that, you know, I started the year sort of with a zero balance. I'd kind of like to end that. I don't want a refund, and I certainly don't want to owe. Well, I kind of feel the same way. I came into this world with nothing, and, well, technically, I'm going to leave with nothing because I don't think anybody's found a way to take it with them in spite of what Steve Martin said in the 70s, that he was taking it with him. But it's one of those things where and as I shared at the opening of the program, you know, my folks have already sent out the will to all of our all of the siblings, so we all know what we're getting. And if we're going to, you know, if there was going to be any squabbling over that, you do it now, you know, while the folks are alive. I have no squabbles. My folks have made the decision that they have made. They're their things, not mine. I really don't have room for any more things. If there was any kind of dollars, if there were any kind of dollars that were going to be available, you know, those would be spent and gone and so forth. So I say, you know, enjoy, you know, mom and dad, enjoy it while you're here because it's yours and it's not mine. And I've always found it was always a strange concept to me, this whole aspect of inheritance. And I know a lot of people really get into that. You know, they really, I don't want to say look forward, although maybe there are some who do. But we're talking more about coming to terms as an individual. I mean, I don't know about you, Holly, and you seem to be, you know, you seem to be fairly young, in spite of the fact that you are a gerontologist, as well as a journalist, studying this whole aspect. And of course, we're all, as the phrase goes, we're all careening, you know, in that direction, towards our senior years from the day we're born, from the day we come here. But it gets more serious, I think, after 50 or 60.
Very true.
Yeah.
And I've joined the ranks. I just had a birthday, and I have entered into a new era. Chronologically, I just received my AARP card in the mail. So thank you for that. But I am aging, and collectively as a society, we share one common denominator. While we're all unique, all different, serve in different ways, throughout the globe, one thing we share every second of every day is we are collectively aging. And we're doing that together.
Now, it is...
So,
go ahead.
Go ahead. It's just so important that we not overlook that along with that comes a certain amount of responsibility to take care of our personal business, not only for us, but for those we hold dear.
Now, I would venture that this process varies a little bit, not only from state to state, but even for that matter, and I'm not sure how broad this is, from country to country?
Very true. This is a global issue, and the fact that people don't want to plan for the inevitable, and there's so many resources available to do this, and yet there is many reasons why people fail to take care of simple things, such as successful implementation of advanced directives and other planning initiatives related to living and dying, the last will and testament. And my goal with this book was to do my part and touch the lives that I could touch to provide a means to leave a written legacy, to establish advanced care planning, and ensure that people's future wishes will be executed accordingly. But it's quite a conundrum that faces the world, and there are many barriers. They include education, understanding, access, and awareness continue to threaten the completion of advanced care planning. And it certainly leaves a medical team and a family in a precarious dilemma, but it also definitely affects individuals.
What about some of the I'm going to say some of the new things that have come along, because my recollections of preparation for dying, basically you draw out, usually through an attorney, a last will and testament, period. That's all you need to do. Just lay it out. And, of course, as I say, you know, my folks have done that. But it seems to me like, A, number one, it's gotten much more complicated, but I wanted to ask you about some of the new things that have been thrown into the mix, specifically, and it's growing state by state here in the United States, the desires on the part of some who basically, they don't want to stick around if they're going to be suffering. And they want the right to die. They want the right to exit on their terms. And that's got to be very difficult to deal with family members. The individual's made the decision, and they're fine with it. Now you're talking about family. Can you address that? And I guess I say, I know it's different from one state to state, because not all the states in this country have it, and I'm not sure what the law is around the world.
Right, and it does vary, and that makes things even more challenging. But digressing back a couple of decades, the Patient Self-Determination Act of 1990 ensured that patients have the right regarding health care decisions, including implementation of advanced directives. In spite of that, so many people still continue to not complete these. Statistics vary, but it is around 30%, and a portion of that 30% are folks that are actually in a situation where they need to complete them because something has come to the forefront. They've just been diagnosed with a medical condition that brings this issue to 3D perspective with them, if you will. There are so many other extenuating circumstances for this type of planning. For example, the states across the United States are not uniform, and many of them have their own forms. So you think about somebody that has a home in Montana and they have a second home in Florida. If you live in Montana and get ill in Montana and need the advanced directives, and you've filled out your advanced directives for the state of Montana, that is one thing. But if you have them for Montana and you're at your other home in Florida, there could be problems in the medical team accepting advanced directives that you've completed for another state. And in the book, I talk about that it's important for you to think of all the places that you visit so that you ensure that while you've completed these important forms, that you've certainly served yourself well in ensuring that wherever something would happen, you have them in place. And many people do believe that the last will and testament, if you've done that, that is your advanced care planning and you're done. And then if you add advanced directives to that, that's another thing that certainly complements the technical side or the legal side of your advanced care planning. As a gerontologist, it was really important to me. You talked about earlier, Richard, about that when you leave, you want to leave with nothing. And so many people agree with you on that mindset and feel that when they leave, they want to leave as they came in, can't take it with you. But what is important about that is what you leave behind, as in the virtual legacy of your memory, how you've left your fingerprint on the world, how you have forever changed human history. And certainly, I promise that Richard Dugan has, for sure, changed with the great work that you do. And there's a way to keep that alive. And so while we may not be concerned with the assets and the concrete things that we have in our lives, this book allows you to face more than the technical and legal matters, but it takes it to a truly personal, emotional facet where you convey your life story, you share your life story, you archive things in your family, such as even traditions and family lineage and health history, which is so important with medical advancements. This book allows you to leave who died in your family of what ailments, which with medical advancements is so important to those we leave behind. So this book is an incredible complement to what most people define as advanced care planning, but it takes it so much further.
In flipping through the book, I came across a section, a very practical section in regards to accounts. And some folks have a lot of them, both credit, savings, checking, stocks, bonds, and the list goes on. And throughout their lives, they've kept those private. You know, it's nobody's business, you know, what assets I have, how much I make, et cetera, how much I spend, and so forth. And yet, here's a section that's, I think, extremely important, because what's going to happen after I go is nobody's going to know the passwords. Nobody's going to know the usernames, the account numbers, and so forth. They may not even know that certain accounts exist. And they could go on in perpetuity, especially, let's say, for example, credit accounts, where I've charged things and I haven't finished paying off the balance. And guess what happens? It just keeps mounting and mounting. And those kinds of things have to be dealt with. Is that section extremely important, or can some other process be put in play, you know, other than me keeping this kind of a record? Some other process where someone could go in and search for all of the accounts of an individual. Obviously, that's going to be more time-consuming and probably more expensive, but certainly that could be done, could it not?
Yes, with great angst, and it's highly problematic, because if you think about it, your life is just that, your life. And those around us, those in our family circle and our loved ones, don't know the many nuances of your day-to-day accounts and things that you use regularly, and particularly things you don't use very often, are even more challenging. In the book, I put that in there, and there's a companion binder that you make separately so that this book, which may be sitting on your coffee table, isn't full of your highly proprietary details such as passwords and account numbers and things like that. But you allude to them in the book and you say, okay, I have this account with this vendor. There's so many things on auto pay. Think about all of the things that we just have on auto pay, or contracts that we have with a lawn service or a pool service or a cable company. And it was so important for me to try to capture all of the things that people have in their lives in a modern world, because we just have so many conveniences today that we did not once have. I think about social media, and it was recently, and this happens, this is one example of probably a very common event, which is a gentleman had passed untimely, and he was younger, I would say in his 40s or 50s, and he had a Facebook account, and with the Facebook account, it, I believe, sends out some sort of notice. You can make your settings where it tells people it's your birthday. And he had passed several months prior to his birthday, and on his birthday, his Facebook account could not be accessed. Nobody knew the password. Nobody could stop it. This is something that, without being able to get into it and knowing how to get into it, this is a train you cannot stop. And on his birthday, it went out to all of the people on his friend network. Give so-and-so a shout-out on their blank birthday.
Yeah.
Well, I think about families that were trying to reach some sort of better level of bereavement and to move on with the process of grief to a healthier state. And I think about getting that email and what a setback that is and how upsetting that is for them. So this account section, where you do log these things, is important for certainly that reason. But if you think about when someone passes, everything that needs to be done, it's inundating. And to make this process easier on those you love is the greatest gift you can give them. They can go right in. You've organized it for them. They make the phone calls, and they're just so happy, and it makes the process so much more peaceful for them. It's bad enough that they've lost somebody, but you've never heard anybody say, so-and-so passed, and I'm so upset they did all the planning. What you hear is, I lost my father, my mother, my whomever, and it was so nice because they'd done all the planning themselves. It changes how people reflect on someone's departure when you've done these things.
When we come back from our break, I want to talk about the reflection, but also talk a little bit about our own personal reflection as we also prepare for that day when I wish I could remember the poetic words of shaking off this coil or whatever the phrase is. I wish I could remember that poem. But nonetheless, we'll be back and we'll talk more. Holly Kelly is my guest, and she is the author of Sunrises and Sunsets. It is the Final Affairs Forged with Flair, Finesse, and Functionality. Functionality. I still haven't. I'll work on that during the break. I'm Richard Duke, and this has been Tell Me Your Story. Stay tuned. We have more coming up.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, working on the pronunciation of Holly Kelly's latest work, Sunrises and Sunsets. That's not where the problem lies. She's a gerontologist as well as a journalist, and she has put this wonderful compendium together. And I've talked with folks over the years about this concept. And matter of fact, we have folks here involved with hospice, Holly, who are on our radio station quite regularly, who talk about, I forget if it's the 5 or 7 question thing that they put out in terms of what you want done. Now, it's not as comprehensive by any means as the Sunrises and Sunsets, but at least it's a starting place where, you know, the conversation begins. And I think that that's extremely important. And before we go any further, let's let our listeners know that they can find out more by going to your website, which is sunrisesandsunsetsbook.com. That's Sunrises and Sunsets, all one word as websites go, sunrisesandsunsets.com. I beg your pardon, sunrisesandsunsetsbook.com. So please check it out. That we encourage you to do so. And you know, as they say, get your house in order. You know, if you don't have a lot, then it won't take long. And as you said, Holly, at earlier in the program, that there seems to be a great deal of peace with the individual who completes the process, as it were, where they can kind of breathe a sigh of relief saying, oh, now that's done. I don't have to worry about that anymore. Well, I would venture that's yes and no.
I can see how you would feel that way. Imagine you're faced with the task of planning your own funeral. How could that possibly be fun? Which was where I, when creating the book, really wanted to get creative. I knew what I was up against when I created this written work. And I was up for the task. I really spent a lot of time trying to figure out how can I close this gap for people? What can I do to make this process engaging? You'll notice the book is in full color. It has quotes, poetry, pictures. There's so many mental breaks, comical, whimsical things in the book that break it up. And that is for a reason, to make the process a literary journey of personal exploration that is enjoyable. And there's stories in there that will resonate with people and help them understand why this matters so much. But when you think about planning your own funeral, I ask my readers to consider that they are no longer here. And this is almost a play or production that you are creating for those left behind to enjoy. And imagine how that removes so much sadness from them, as what you have created and meticulously orchestrated is almost put on for them as your final thoughts are conveyed. And it is just something that, as you're planning your own funeral, you actually get engaged in this process and start enjoying it. And I say it's almost like a secret you're keeping, in that the little special things that you're incorporating into this and how they will be perceived on the other side when you're no longer here. It's fun.
You know, it's strange that you would put it in that context, because for the last, oh, I don't know, maybe a couple of years, I've been sitting here at this microphone and thinking, I wonder if I should record a show where I've passed on, and it would only be aired. But I have no guarantee that, you know, we'll continue on next week, next month, or next year, let alone if I make it like my plan is to live older than my great-grandmother. She lived to be 100 years old. I used to tell my family at reunions, when she was in her 90s, early 90s, that I was going to outlive her. And as she aged, I would say the same thing, but say, and she's making it really hard. But I've often wondered about that, about leaving some kind of message. If you're listening, you know, the standard opening. If you're listening to this, if you're watching this video, I've died. I've passed on.
And I love that. Yes. I just talked to my mom, who's working the book for a second time. She's actually has a real book now instead of my paper manuscript. And she said, I'm working on my obituary. I'm like, yay, oh, you. Wow. And she said, I'm going to make it fun. And she said, I have my first line figured out. If you're reading this, I'm no longer here. And when people do plan their own funeral and do write their own obituary, you can tell the difference. And it certainly takes the sting while anybody that you would lose that you care about is incredibly sad and filled with anguish and loss, grief and bereavement. There is some sort of bright, happy light when you are not burdened with having to create this on someone else's behalf. And there's personal peace and life elevation when you do it yourself. So to leave that, you have my endorsement, Richard, to do that. I love the idea. And in the book, we talk about so many ways that you can say your farewell in a way that resonates with those you're leaving behind.
And as I say, if I were to do it now, I could go back to and listen to it in 45 years and say, well, maybe I need to update it a little bit.
Do some tweaking here. I've learned some things. There are some things and perspectives may have changed. And that's what's great about the book is this book is not for the aged. It is for any adult of any age who believes that they may someday die.
Well, we know that's going to happen. But there's another aspect of this process that you can't really put down on paper. And that is the more esoteric, spiritual, metaphysical aspects. I'm curious as to how you've dealt with that, not only as a gerontologist, but also in your work here, Sunrises and Sunsets. Because that's the one thing that I have learned is that you cannot argue belief, and I would never try, especially on this subject. By the same token, we all have them about a myriad of different subjects. And death in particular, people want to say that I know that I'm going here, or I know that there's nothing after this, or, you know, or whatever the conclusions that they've come to based upon the information they've gathered. Tell me how you, Holly, have addressed this, both in your book, but also for yourself.
Well, in the book, there's chapter 15 is Me, Myself, and I. And this is where you share so much about yourself. There is the section where you talk about special anniversaries or milestones and family traditions that if you didn't write them down, they actually may be lost in your entire genealogical fingerprint of your lineage. So, so many different lessons and things like that are in there. Also in that section, I wanted this book to appeal to everyone. And while I am the initial author of the book and my name is on the cover, I wanted readers to become part of this process, to engage with this book, and to become one with this book. The truth is that how I accomplish that is by allowing it to be not just a guidebook or a book, but offering the platform for it to be a workbook. And the reader themselves are the final author of this book. On page 166, it says, "What are your thoughts regarding the afterlife or what happens when we die?" And there's a space in there for you to convey that. If you believe in the afterlife, who do you hope is waiting on the other side to greet you? There is question after question that many people will find they have never even thought about because the questions have never been asked before. And this is a way to kind of solidify your spiritual outlooks, perspectives, and personal journey spiritually as well. As far as myself, getting to the second part of that question, how do I do that? I believe that life is not a dress rehearsal. Life is something that I believe you need to get right the first time. And if you get things wrong along the way, it's so important that you learn from that. I'm a student of life. And I consider, as a gerontologist and my extreme interest in the field of thanatology, that any day could be my day. And I am very good about telling those in my life and those in my world that I cherish how much I love them. I don't believe that there are many things in life, or I don't believe that there are too many things in life worth spending a lot of time on, because if you really think about it and you measure it up against, would this be an issue if you were at the end of your life? Would this be an issue if you just got a diagnosis that could take you? And I try to measure things about really how important is it, because so many things that we spend time on today are irrelevant in the grand scheme of things. We make them something, but truly, if push came to shove and circumstances were in a different place, we wouldn't spend any time on them at all. And I try to live like that.
You know, you've said something that I find that I agree with so wholeheartedly, but that others around me, especially people who are very close to me, don't understand. In spite of the majority of my career being spent at news and information stations, honestly, I hate the news. I don't want to watch it. I don't want to hear it. I know, since man has been on the planet, of his inhumanity to self, if you will put it in that general context. Why do I need to keep hearing that stuff? And I alluded to a little bit of that at the beginning of the program. And I want to fill my heart, mind, and soul, and body with the good things of life. Now, does this mean that I am denying and ignoring? Absolutely not. I know this stuff exists, but I'm not going to live my life in fear. If it's my time, it's my time. There's nothing I can do about it. And I don't know how that is calculated. I don't know how that is scheduled, let alone randomized.
Well, I love that you are so honest.
And I'll be honest with you, I really try not to pass judgment on others who want to, but it's like, mm-hmm. How is this helping you?
It's a personal journey, and some people find that it doesn't impact them, perhaps, or that they are just so interested in what is going on, even though it may be negative and affect them negatively, emotionally and personally. I am with you. My family knows I can't watch the news, and we're only here for a short period of time. So for me personally, I do share that kind of protocol as you do, because I want to fulfill my life with things that are enriching, that promote me as a human being, as a person, as a mother, a wife, and that allow me to do my best work. And things that are going to negatively impact me, that are going to keep me or derail me from being able to serve others and serve myself and my family, I'm not interested in spending time on those things, because it's not promoting my best self now. And I talk in the book over and over about your best life now. So I think it's important that we kind of define, know yourself, what is a distraction for you being your best person, and incorporate the best of what life has to offer so that you can have a fulfilling life and a productive life, in that you're happy and you're whole and complete. I think that the news and things like that is certainly important. It's not that I'm any more like you than ignoring it. It's hard to ignore. But while we know those things are going on, I still choose to promote happy and inspirational thoughts so that I'm able to do what I need to do.
And you're dealing with obviously, because this program has taken on a rather serious tone, which is fine. You know, every show has its tone. But there is an undercurrent of compassion, of understanding. I have only lost one or two very close individuals in my life. One of them was my grandmother on my mother's side when I was probably 7 or 8 years old. Probably, even as I think back on it, one of the worst experiences I can ever remember. Thank God it didn't traumatize me, although I was threatened to be removed from the church. That's how upset I was. Mm-hmm. And then I remember when a dear friend of ours passed away in our home. And actually, I should back that up and say that I had an incredible experience when my grandmother passed away. In spite of my emotions in the church, she passed away in our home. I mean, my parents' home down in Phoenix. It was over Thanksgiving weekend. I remember that she took us years earlier to a drive-in theater in Florence, Arizona, to see The Sound of Music, her favorite movie. That particular Thanksgiving evening, they showed The Sound of Music on TV, and we were all sitting around the TV along with my grandmother watching, and we all went to bed. And according to one of my sisters, my grandmother had gotten up, gone to the restroom, come back, laid down, and never got up again. So she passed away in a place that was filled with love for her, for one another, a very warm home. It was a wonderful experience in spite of what happened to me, you know, in the church. But then my dear friend passed away when I was 40-something. I can't remember. 2003, and he passed away in the home of myself and my wife. And I remember 2 days after his passing, I was thinking about how other people reacted. You know, and so a lot of people would just spend days crying, and others, you know, they'd have these angry outbursts, you know. And the next thing I knew, I was screaming and yelling madder than hell that he had gone, like it was his fault. How do you prepare people, or is there even preparation for the eventuality? I mean, I can intellectualize my reaction to my parents' passing. I mean, I'm close to them, yes. And I'm grateful for everything that they have given me, including the life that I live today. And at the same time, I also know they're both in their 80s and they're going to go one day.
Right. But,
and it's like, and why should that be a problem for me? And I guess that's where we start with, how do you prepare someone?
Well, acknowledging it for sure is an opportunity for you to, there is something called death preparedness, and that's considering it and thinking about it, to, you know, talk about those very thoughtful and touching stories you just shared. Those were your cultural factors that molded and defined your views of death. And death perspectives are kind of created through social, cultural, religious, ethnicity, different factors that contribute to how we as individuals, and for each individual it's different, define our views towards death, dying, and loss. You talked about your anger. And Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who has since passed, but iconic in the studies of death, dying, loss, and bereavement, she came up with the 5 different emotions that we deal with regarding death and its denial: anger, bargaining, depression, and eventually acceptance. How we deal personally, I can't fathom the thought of losing my mother, whom is amazing and best mom ever, dedicated my book to her. I recognize, though, that in reality, as did you mention, that our lives do come to an end. And so it's so important to me to make each experience count, to ensure that her planning is in place so that her individual preferences at the end of life, as well as post-death, are carried out to her wishes. And I recognize also that she would want me to continue to live an amazing life after her departure. So we've had many conversations of this, because you don't have a gerontologist interested in thanatology for a daughter without, she's like, when is this book going to be done? When can I live my life again? Oh my God, I'm worried about dying all the time. When is this going to be over so I can live again? We have this joke in the family because of what I do. But the truth is everybody's getting more comfortable with it, and it's becoming a joke that is something that, as real as it is, people are starting to lower their anxiety about it and to become more comfortable. And you would be amazed at what happens when the death conversation has taken place. The dark cloud that has been looming over your family is gone. You've eradicated it, and there's just this breath of fresh air that enters into your relationship after that, that you are no longer ignoring that. And to sit down with your mom and say, what do you want? Do you want a cremation? Do you want a burial? I mean, the book takes care of this, every detail of it, for readers. But for those that don't have the book and have had that conversation, it certainly changes the dynamic of your relationship, and you're no longer avoiding it. I mean, you've gone there. And it feels good afterwards that you have, the easy thing to do is never typically the best thing to do. I always tell my kids, usually the harder thing is the right thing. Well, it's hard to have a death talk, but it's the right thing to do.
Yeah. I'd only challenge you on one point that you made. Mm-hmm. That is that my mom is the best mom in the world.
I think that we have a tie.
I think we all do, all 7 billion of us, and it's I often would again intellectualize the process, thinking, well, you know, if we just stopped getting attached to one another, then we wouldn't have all of this stuff going on every time someone passes on. Kind of hard not to do that, especially
hard not to do that, and we have pets, and imagine the friends that you have. I mean, this is a true loss. This is not minimized at all, because it's a fur kid. I mean, we have loss all around us, and I will tell you that, just to back up on that previous question, I lost someone young, too, in our home, and my stepdad had colon cancer, and I am a big fan of palliative care, and I think it is very important that when the opportunity is available, most people want to have palliative care, and while there's a term for it now, when someone dies at home around people that they love, that's typically a great example of palliative care and to ease their comforts and make them comfortable. But I lost my grandmother at the age of 13. When I was 10 years old, my stepdad died, and I will never forget that night. And we waited for a nurse to come, because somebody has to declare that the individual has died, and that's what we were waiting on.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget what happened. Is she came to our home, went in and saw him in his room, and then came to me as a 10-year-old young girl and said, now I just want to tell you, then I've gone in and saw your daddy, and he's in a deep, deep sleep. He's sleeping. He's comfortable. He feels no pain, and he's just fine. But he's in a very deep sleep that he just can't wake up from. And that was the worst thing that I could have heard, because I continue to hold on to hope. And as a society, we do believe, it seems universally, that it's so important to protect kids. And I, you know, research proves, and in my life personally, I recognize that the truth is that talking to kids in a way that is appropriate for their emotional level and for where they are at, both chronologically, their emotional and growth and developmental stage, it's so important to be honest with them and speak to them in a manner that does at least convey to them, as challenging as death is, that what has happened is final. I mean, it is a part of life, and we think that sheltering kids helps them, but I remember what I went through and sounds similar to, you know, some of the trauma that you experience as a child in trying to understand death as a young person. And so telling the truth on their emotional and developmental level, even when pets die, is super important to not protect them, because it does help them have death experiences that help shape their understanding of life and death.
I think the hardest deaths for me to take, were not even the ones that I've mentioned. The hardest deaths for me to take are those that I didn't find out about until years after. I was married my first marriage was 15 years. We spent 15 Thanksgivings and Christmases and New Year's and holidays and football seasons and on and on and on. And I only found out 3 or 4 years after the fact that my ex-father-in-law passed away from an aneurysm that he'd had for decades. They knew it was there. There was nothing they could do. It was inoperable. And my ex-mother-in-law, she passed away 4 months later from a broken heart. And then my ex-wife's best friend died on the operating table. I never received a call. And it was like,
wow,
those 15 years meant nothing to any of these people? That's what hurt more than anything else.
Well, it's important that you brought that up. It is in the book. And on page 115, throughout your life, you have known a lot of people, some of whom remain very special to you. They would want to know, of course, but also they need to know. And this is where you make that list of all of the people that may be only known to you that would need to be contacted. It's in the event of my death, the following people should be notified. There's the quick list of obvious family and friends and stockbroker, attorney, insurance brokers, accountants, the funeral home, your employer. And then there's the more detailed page of maybe your high school friend that nobody even knows how to contact. Imagine that all of these folks would be overlooked and what that feels like to them, or to even send an email and not get a reply. You've lived that. You know how important that is. And so it was important for me to incorporate that in the book because, again, it comes back to it is our lives, and we know it. And had they had the book, you'd have been on the list, and you would have been able to at least have the opportunity to grieve.
Yeah. Yeah. And instead of grieving, I got angry. And,
correct.
And I'll be honest with you, I don't think I've resolved it completely yet, but I've calmed down.
Because you never had closure.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, it's not to say that I would have been able to go to the funerals or anything of that nature, but at least I would have known. I think one of the main reasons why I'm not on Facebook, why I'm not a social media person like most folks are, and certainly maybe to my detriment, I don't know. I found out about one of the icons when I was a kid growing up in broadcasting. He and his wife took their own lives because of such traumatic experiences that were happening to them at that time. And within a few months, I said, I'm done. I can't. This is crazy. I mean, I probably still would have found out about it, but it was one of those things where, like, wow, social media certainly can get you the information fast. But at the same time, there's a certain level of dispassionateness to it. And I'm curious about your perspectives on, I mean, you've sort of addressed this aspect of talking with children and being honest with them. But what about that aspect of the intellectual aspect of today at 417, so-and-so passed away in, Birmingham, Alabama, blah, 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 and leaves behind X number of children on the news, you know, a famous person kind of thing. You know, as opposed to, I have something I need to tell you. It's very important. I need you to sit down and listen. And I know there is no right way. I think Elizabeth Kubler-Ross listed that. Yes, here are the stages of grieving. And here's how you initialize that stage by addressing it in this fashion and saying these words, and it will go so much easier.
I certainly feel that personal elements incorporated into news of that degree is of paramount importance. And, you know, to send it by Morse code or in other ways can not allow the receiver of such news to have any dialogue. It's one-sided. And there's, you know, today in our modern era, we are a society that's victim of having less time and being busy and using modern conveniences to communicate and convey what once was done by letter writing, phone calls, gatherings. And I call myself an antiquated, contemporary, antiquated contemporary, because I do believe that so many values of our ancestors and of future generations of how we lived are somewhat being compromised as we develop more as a society technologically, and you have both heads of households working, and there's so little time today. And so we rely on these modern conveniences, but it certainly, in my opinion, is at a price oftentimes, because the connecting and the genuine time for sharing, sitting on a front porch in a rocking chair, just being. And I do feel like we're getting away from a society of just being. And there is, everything has to be filled with some sort of event or a way to spend your time. And so I kind of dig my heels in a little bit, and I want to definitely make sure I don't lose those elements from my family dynamic or my life. And I'm not alone. There's other people that say, okay, wait, got to slow down a little bit here, and let's remember what matters most. So there are many ways to communicate the loss of someone. There's actual memorial sites online where people can share, and I do believe that there's positive that generates from that, because you get to go in and you get to say something special, and that's healing for the person doing that type of expression or post, if you will. But there's also, you know, some of the human elements that could get lost along the way if we're just not careful in how we handle those.
It's not, certainly not an easy subject to dive into, and that's okay. We do that here on a regular basis, and it's extraordinary to me that as sophisticated as a society that we have, or as we have, it's probably the one subject. You can talk about sex. You can talk about religion and politics. And you can end up in a myriad of states. But when you start talking about death and dying, a lot of times I think people just want to walk away.
You have just brought up taboo. And globally, again, I think people feel like if they talk about it, it's contagious. Nobody does want to talk about that. And I'll tell you what brings us really close to not being able to ignore that is attending a funeral for someone that you care about, or even supporting a friend or someone your own age. As we grow older, we attend more of those. That is a very sobering moment. And those events do not allow you to ignore death. And we're very much recognizing it in those moments, and we have thought and reflection post-funerals, but it doesn't take us too long to get back to the business of living again. And I think part of the burden of death is that people don't have all of their things in order, and you think about those you leave behind. I asked the question in the book, are you more concerned personally about your passing or what it would do to others? And then I asked to explain in, you know, the details of your answer and why that is. And I do believe that if you've worked the process, either of the book, or you've done what I, as a gerontologist, consider comprehensive advanced care planning, that it's not so scary anymore. You realize that you've done everything in place. You have written your letters to loved ones if you're not here, and you have a child that you can think about, that you have written these letters to my daughter on her wedding day, and you're not here. You've been gone 10, 15 years, and the letters are still keeping your memory alive, your love alive, incorporating it into their living life as your living legacy. And I think about this young girl ready to walk down the aisle, missing her mother, wishing her mother was here for that experience. And she's looking at this sealed envelope that says, "To my daughter on her wedding day." And she gets to open that envelope before she walks down the aisle. I think what a beautiful gift that you can leave to those you love. And we don't know when. So that's why I love these letters. And I have this section in the book specifically for that. If you have an untimely passing, I mean, we would all probably argue that any passing is untimely. But there is a certain sense of societal, chronological, or social expectations of when death is especially difficult. And we consider that, we use the colloquial term, before your time. And so if you do pass before your time, these letters live on for you, convey your love, keep you in their life, and you're able to pass on your wishes for them, what you hope for them, what's important that they continue to do. What were your goals?
Yeah, that's a phrase that ranks right up there for me with, and changed the course of history, because we just don't know. I get so annoyed with documentaries that will be portraying an event, and they'll say, and here's the event that changed the course of history. Well, what was the course? You know, how do you know what the course was? Maybe this was the course. And untimely passing, that's what we call it. But as I said before, earlier in the program, and again, my perspective, mind you, mine only, that if it's my time, it's my time. If people want to say it's an untimely because, quote unquote, I died too young, well, not necessarily. Maybe I died at the right age. I mean, this was when I was supposed to go. I completed my tasks. It's one of the subject matters that we talk about too, is when a person has finished the work that they came here to do. And of course, this is more on a more spiritual level, but I remember interviewing a gal, 15, 16 years ago. And she shared with me a story of a 94-year-old woman who she was taking care of. And the woman was spry and excited and having a great time and doing the things that she wanted to do. But one day she came to my friend and said, "I've done all I want to do." Now, the woman was not mentally ill. She didn't have any problems in that regard, wasn't terminal. She says, "I'm done. There's nothing else that I want to experience here. I want to go. I want to go on to the next realm and experience that." Now, I realize this brings up a whole other subject, but in terms of trying to view it from that standpoint, matter of fact, you know, you brought up our pets. And we did a little research after the passing of one of our dogs not that long ago. And someone told us that, well, he was here to get you here and get you to a certain point, and his work was done. And I don't know if that's just another way for us to be able to handle it better in the grieving process or exactly what. But, you know, that kind of made sense to me. And I'm wondering if that helps people, saying, look, they finished the work that your grandmother finished the work she was doing. Your brother finished the work he was doing, and he needs to go on elsewhere and do other work that he's called to do. Your perspective on something like that?
Well, definitely. Culturally, it varies greatly on how people try to handle their thoughts on someone passing. And so there's just so many different views and perspectives on that topic. I do believe that if that is helpful to someone, and it can be, to think about that they were working on this and they brought this project to fruition, or, you know, the thought that young lady you were speaking of said, you know, I've done my work, you know, that's almost my work is done here. and now I'm ready. And that's certainly somebody that's established a great amount of peace. Death is a great unknown, and I think that's what makes it elusive and stirs incredible fear towards the topic and discussion of it, because we really don't know. It's kind of a blend of what your personal perspectives are and what we, you know, hear that we decide that, okay, that works for us. I can consider that when I consider, you know, what death experiences really are, and I agree with that for me personally.
Yeah.
And so,
well,
I think that
I find it a little almost socially hypocritical of us to sit here and say you can end a job, you can end a marriage, you can end a mortgage, you can end a career, you can end a number of different things, but you cannot end your life. And yet we'll turn right around and say, I don't want my dog to suffer. I want him to, let's go ahead and put him down. And I'm going, wait a minute. I mean, don't get me wrong. I have a great deal of, a great depth of love for the animals that are in my life now. But I'd rather have a little more compassion for the human being who says, I'm done.
And yes, that's a debatable issue, and
yeah,
I believe
and
right
I know
now
that's
we're
a Pandora's box.
Oregon and Washington that have instilled laws where euthanasia is something that, you know, can be done. I know that individually you're thinking of others in that example, but even individually, people have thought about, if this happens to me, I'll take care of it myself.
Yeah.
And, you know, they don't want to go that road of, you know, having a terrible dread disease of some kind. And so people are like, I'll just take care of this myself. Mm-hmm. When often, you know, nobody wants to hear that because it's an awful thought of somebody doing that. But the truth is what they're really saying is, I don't want to suffer.
Yeah.
I don't want to lose my dignity. I don't want to be a burden to other people. It is the great debate. There was a time as a young girl that I believe that life had its course and that I am not the divine to make those decisions for other living things in my life that I cared about. And I was hardcore on those thoughts until I watched one of my horses suffer and suffer so bad that I wanted to make it end, and I knew death was imminent for this beautiful, valiant animal. And I sat there and grappled with what had been my previous perspectives and knew what I must do for this animal and remove the pain. So I understand what you're looking at, because unfortunately I've had to be in a position that nobody wants to be in, where something was suffering to the degree that you needed to help them and love them.
Well, I have had to do that on at least one occasion in the last 15 years. My present wife had four Siberian Huskies, and they were all getting old. And at one point, one of them was there in the vet's office, laying there on the counter or what have you. And my wife did not want to make the decision. She did not want to be responsible for the death of this animal. And I said, okay, then I will take on that responsibility, and I will ask you point blank, do you want her to suffer, or do you want to set her free from her suffering? And she said, of course, I want to set her free from her suffering. I said, then I will go ahead and make the decision, and we'll have her put down. And I did that. And certainly, you know, we were both very, very understanding of what was happening. And of course, then dog number two, same kind of thing, and dog number three. And we moved here to Santa Barbara, where dog number four actually came with us. We actually believe we gave him an extra year of life, good life, while he was here. And he passed away in the yard. I mean, you know, with the other dogs around him. which was the best thing for them, whereas the other three were taken out of the pack, which drove him crazy. I mean, we were beside ourselves with what to do with him because he was grieving so deeply. And I'm sorry, I don't care what anybody says. Animals have souls.
Oh, Richard, I have, when I was a young girl, I had horses when I was off at college. They were always together. I came home and always rode, something I looked very forward to. But these two horses had been together for probably 18 years, and I lost one horse to heaves. And they were in the pasture together. And I do find it certainly thoughtful and polite, but the person actually executing, you know, ending the life, such as the veterinarian, always says, you know, well, you probably want to leave and I'll do this. And I'm real intent on this animal's never left my side. I will stay here and love them and rub them through the entire thing. I will be that person, and I will muster up that strength because I love this animal and they're not dying with a stranger. So we put this horse down, and it was, the horse had been down and was not getting up again. So I had about six horses back then, and the other four went back to, you know, food, which is predominantly on horses' minds. But the horse that had been with him for that many years would not leave. And, you know, you think about a dog, you can pick a dog up and provide a proper burial or whatever, you know, your plans are for that. You can't do that with a 1,200-pound animal. So it takes some orchestrating, of course. And while that animal sat there after, you know, he had passed, my other horse just stood over him, head down, and next thing I know, my other horse went down. So we buried the first horse. My other horse never got up. I would take it feed. He would eat, laying down, sitting, you know, in a laying down position, sitting up with its head up, and would eat. And I called the vet out 3 days later, and I said, I can't get this horse up. I don't know what's wrong. I'm sorry, you were here 3 days ago for the other horse. I don't know what's going on. The vet looked at me and said, this horse is dying of a broken heart.
Mm-hmm. And that has been determined to be a valid diagnosis these days.
And he did die.
Yeah.
He was dead that night. He was perfectly fine, and he died that night. So animals have feelings, too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
They do get attached. We see this in people, and honestly, we see it in people, and we're almost like we find it tender. That they loved each other that much and they had that strong of a connection and that kind of life journey together. It's beautiful in the worst of ways.
Yeah. If you've just joined us, my guest is Holly Kelly. She is a gerontologist. You mentioned something else, and I can't remember, a sanatologist?
Yes. Thanatology is the study of death, dying, loss, and bereavement.
And then that's, strangely enough, in spite of my conversations over the years, that's the first time I've ever heard that term. That's new to me. Which
good.
Is
we're keeping you fresh.
I appreciate that. I have to say, as touching as the story was about the horses, the one thing that flashed in my mind was the scene, and because I kind of want to get into this part before we wrap up our program, the fun part. But what flashed in my mind was the scene from City Slickers. After the chuck wagon had gone over the cliff with the horses and so forth, and Mitch, after they've buried the two horses, says, now, let's just take stock of what we buried today, because they'd already buried, I can't remember, Palance, the character's name. And I don't know why that came to mind. It just it sort of made me think of this has been, I think, a very good program, but I want to find out where's the functionality in all of this? I mean, it's great to have the peace after you've completed this process, but where's the fun?
The fun is a variety of places. The fun is sharing your family lineage and your history, creating your family tree. The fun is sharing your life story in the All About Me section. The fun is leaving a written legacy, knowing that that's going to be alive for you. And to resolve through the Kick the Bucket List, to resolve past regrets and transgressions, forgiveness of yourself or others, to live with a clear conscience moving forward. And that's a beautiful gift that people can do for themselves because, again, sometimes we get caught up in, when measured against life and death, some pretty trivial issues as individuals. We all are a victim of doing that. But when you really think about the end and what you'd like to have right, why wait? Get it done now. Live great now. And so the fun is incorporating incredible, meaningful living through your bucket list and living your life like your bucket list. So this is a user-friendly, uplifting book that is as much about living as it is about dying.
Hmm. Well, I want to thank you so much for taking so much time to share with us. As we both acknowledge, it's not an easy subject to talk about, no matter how much ease you have in talking about it, because you're never sure about the response of the other participants in the conversation. And I thank you so much for your honesty. And I encourage you that if you should find yourself in the Santa Barbara area, we'd love to have you in studio to actually continue this conversation.
Oh, Richard, I feel blessed, and I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Before we wrap up the program, three questions that I ask my guests before I let them go. And a reminder, if you would like to get more information, it's easy. You can go to her website, which is sunrisesandsunsetsbook.com. That's sunrisesandsunsetsbook.com. And actually, before I ask my three questions, I have one other one. Why is it plural? Sunrises and sunsets.
Sunrises, because we don't experience just one. Originally, the title was intended to symbolize the life cycle of birth and death. Obviously, you know, birth being the sunrises and death being the sunset. And the space in between, the day, if you will, is to mirror life's journey. We have many sunrises and sunsets that tell our life story. I added the subtitle. I love alliteration, and it kind of more explains what the book is. But I think of life as our many sunrises and sunsets. Mm. And we're in awe when we see a sunset. You cannot not be moved by that. And I want people to be moved by their life just as they are by a sunrise and a sunset.
Sunrises and sunsets. Final affairs forged with flair, finesse, and functionality. Alliteration. I don't get it. Anyway, first of all, who is Holly Kelly?
Who is Holly Kelly? Wow. I am someone that definitely takes life, I think, serious as far as what we're here to do. I believe that we're all given a gift and that we should try to seek out those gifts and figure out what they are and use them for the betterment of ourselves and the society and the world that we live in. I think that finding that gift is one of life's most important treasure hunts. And I believe that if we don't use our gifts that we've identified and we've found, that we don't only lose them, but we can lose part of ourselves along the way. So I definitely believe that life is the boomerang effect. What you send out returns with astonishing momentum. I call that fulfillment, and I like to live a fulfilled life.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you are doing now?
I want to help others define their life journey and incorporate more enthusiastic living in their everyday living. This book is as much for the individual completing it as it is a gift for those you leave behind to think about how I can alleviate some of the burden, some of the worst of times for people, and have a daughter or son pick up this book and start flipping through the pages and see these beautiful words that have been so kindly written by someone they've lost. That moves me as a human being, and it enriches me professionally to know that I can provide a platform where people can be happy in the worst of times and spark a smile in the midst of grief. So I hope to accomplish comfort and more ease of looking at death and perspectives of death, and giving people the means to plan so that they personally benefit as well as their family.
And what is your life's purpose?
Oh, my goodness. I think my life's purpose, first and foremost, is to be the best mom I can be. I consider that the most divine gift that each of us received, and what an incredible blessing to be able to raise children. So I think my first gift is that the highest calling of duty that I think a human being can have is to be entrusted with beautiful children, and to balance work in a professional life where you serve beyond your family and you're able to serve others as well. And I believe that my call to action is to use this gift that I've been given, that I'm grateful for, of writing and my studies and interests that evolved, and allow them to serve people in a positive way.
Holly Kelly, thank you once again for joining us on the program, author of Sunrises and Sunsets, and we look forward to talking with you again in this new year.
Thank you very much. It's been my pleasure. I've very much enjoyed our discussions.
As have I. I'm Richard Dugan. We've been talking with Holly Kelly, author of Sunrises and Sunsets. The website, sunrisesandsunsetsbook.com. That's sunrisesandsunsetsbook.com. We will be linked to her website, so certainly we encourage you to check out this information. I think that it's very valuable. I think it's very important, and I think you need to at least investigate it. Even if you don't do anything with it, at least you've kind of got the seed planted. We encourage you to foster that as well. I'm Richard Dugan. Until next time, this is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Love to all.